future. Not a future that will be, but one that might be. This is not a new world. It is simply an extension of what began in the old one. It has refinements, technological advances.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network with your host, Tom Metzger.
What? I like to look at tattoos on people. I think they're really cool, you know? But I would never get one. I always thought it was a bad idea to let some guy draw a picture on me that'll probably never come off, you know? I'm conservative on this one. Not only the thing never comes off, but it hurts to put it on. And you gotta pay the guy. Plus, if you do want to take it off, it hurts again, and you gotta pay the guy again. Another reason not to get a tattoo is that a tattoo is positive identification. No one should ever do anything to help the police in any way, especially when you may be the object of their interest.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker on Freya's Day. Ladies' Day in the bunker. Put a little George Carlin on there for you ladies this morning about those tattoos. That helps everybody identify you if they grab you along the highway, man. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations, and they should have been in by yesterday for the month of April. So that's the thing to do. Get with it, and to send your snail mail. And also any donations you'd like to send along to various inmates that have had to do with the struggle. And, of course, you can send them you can send your money and your funds directly to the inmates, too. And those addresses are up on our resist.com website. And you can go there and get the federal address in Iowa to send your money orders and each state has its own setup. So anyhow, that's the way that goes. And it's another overcast and cool day here. I mean, you know, a few days ago we had over 90 degrees, and now it's down last night down into the, I guess, high 30s. Isn't that wonderful? Don't forget, our webmaster has gone to the trouble of setting up another section on resist.com website for antique and old archive material that we're gradually digging out and refurbishing and putting it up there. And if you'd like to send an additional $5 with your donation and stipulate that you want the password for that archive file of older material, audio material, well, we'll set you up. That's right. Don't forget, always put your email address inside the envelope when you send a donation in, because I don't keep names in files. I simply keep email addresses. So if you want credit for your donation, always make sure you do that. Even if you don't have a return address on the envelope and on the inside have your email address, as long as I get that, we're all set. Now, yesterday we had a little problem because the webmaster was run out of her home by the fire. I have some children, some young people of mine out there around San Diego, and the fires are all around all of them. And you know, John and his family ended up in a hotel, and various people went in different directions. And, so I guess today they're starting to get back into their houses. So for you people who have just simply a code to get your daily radio show, you wouldn't have got it yesterday, so let me know, and I can send it out to you, or let the webmaster at merchandiseresist@yahoo.com know, and she will send you out a copy of yesterday's show if you didn't get it. Also, if we've cut you off because of your donations for the show that didn't come in, well, if there's an error there or a mistake, contact merchandiseresist@yahoo.com or contact me and we'll straighten it out. I've been asked to do one weekend show in addition to what I normally do on another service, possibly to drum up more people who will subscribe to our show here. I'm not sure whether I'm going to do that. It takes a lot of work. To me, it's a lot of work every day to do the show, and then to add another extra show on. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I'm thinking about it. Also, I have a long list of emails that have been just sitting there, and so I've been sending out a little news bulletin every day to this long list of several hundred people. And if you happen to get one of these updates and you already get the information because you're a donator to the club, just don't worry about it, or just tell me and I'll knock you off that list. So if you get information twice, that's the reason. And a lot of people out there need some kind of information. I've gotten several people who recontacted me and said how they appreciate these news updates. Well, let's start off with a little Jesus never existed information here that I'm sure that most of you have heard some of this before, but I think we need to hear more of it, because it is my opinion that Christianity is one of the great impediments to the advancement of our race, and has been for a long time. I was sitting in my dentist's office yesterday for a while, and there was two older ladies sitting there with me, and the subject of the weather and so forth came up, and the one lady opened the door for me in a sense when she says, "Well, it's all in God's hands," and I couldn't help but take the bait. I said, "Well, I think it's more in nature's hands," and we had a little conversation there, friendly. You know, I don't like to get pushy, especially with older people and older ladies. And I pointed out a few things to her, but it was obvious that these people are going to carry these beliefs to their death, no matter what, especially the older ones. That's why I try to get this information out to younger people, and especially if you can get it to them before they're in high school. High school is okay, but I'd like to get this information to them even in grade school or junior high school, because you're more apt to get them before their mind has been totally brainwashed in these mind control centers that are everywhere. And so anyhow, I talked to her for about the two ladies for about 15 minutes, and it was obvious that it was just a stone wall. There was no way at all you'll ever dissuade them from anything, because they kept coming back to, "Well, it's faith." And I kept saying, "Well, faith is something that you do without evidence." And, well, it's just faith, and either we're going to heaven or we're going to burn in hell. So I politely left the conversation, and without upsetting them too much. However, they probably had a lot to talk to driving home. But I'm just saying that with most people, as adults, it's very difficult to get anything new to them because they get so set in their ways. We even get set in our ways in our struggle because there's a lot of information out there and a lot of new information that can be brought forward that may change our attitude somewhat. I'm not saying we're going to change our mind on the race issue or that, this or that, but one thing that's been bugging me lately is on the History Channel, they've had a lot of pretty well put together documentaries on National Socialist technology and science in Germany in that short period of time that they were in power. And also toying with this hard-to-believe situation where some people have said that were working in their scientific projects that they had help. And then when asked, what do you mean, the person just pointed straight up. And I don't think he was talking about the Jew God. So that is interesting, and that's a little bit of a far stretch, but could it be possible that the Third Reich exhibited such advanced thinking and scientific prowess that aliens may have made contact with them? I mean, now that is very bizarre, I'm sure I'm going to hear it back from the right wing. Now Metzger thinks that the flying saucer people talked to Adolf Hitler. I'm just saying that there's quite a bit of stuff floating around there. And if the more plausible story is that in ancient times that aliens did either plant the Aryans on this earth or influenced biologically the being a certain segment of the beings that were here as an advanced race, and if that is so, perhaps all of the problems that National Socialism in Germany had as far as the war and all that's concerned, maybe it was something more positive than what we think. Because the basis of everything, all the technology in this country, the United States, pertaining to anything like space or even weaponry like that, came out of Germany. It really did. I mean, they should have called it, it wasn't the space race, it was the space German race. And so that's something to consider that may alleviate some of the criticisms we've had of exactly what was going on with the Jews and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, I say we keep digging and we keep adding little pieces of the puzzle together, and so you can't always just remain static on something, and you've got to be learning something all the time. Anyhow, let's have play this little deal about Jesus that you've probably heard, but I think we need to hear it every once in a while.
There is a big difference between a history embroidered with propaganda, such as we find, for example, in Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars, and a fantasy placed into a historical setting. Such an example that would be Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. The Jesus Tale is very much in the latter category, a fictional drama in which a stereotypic hero has been intruded into a more or less realistic historical landscape. As we would expect from a fictional creation, there exists not a single contemporary reference to such a character, not a single genuine artifact, nothing to substantiate that he ever walked the earth. The traditional authorized version of Christian origins is a Big Bang theory. It suggests that one fine day the only begotten son of God materialized in a virgin's womb. He grew to manhood, assembled his disciples, imparted his wisdom, died, and rose again. from this a religion was born. How far should the rational thinker buy into this story? The idea of Jesus convinces many that someone must lie beneath the encrusted legends. Many, of course, reduce the Christian superstar to a dimly perceived good man, who perhaps said some wise words, fell foul of Roman and Jewish authorities, and managed to get himself crucified. The Big Bang Theory now boils down to little more than Christianity exists, it must have begun somewhere, it began with a single character, here's my version of who he really was. And favourites include an itinerant philosopher, or a religious reformer, a pacifist like Gandhi, or a militant like Che Guevara. In fact, Jesus has been reformed 100 times. One thing of which historians and New Testament scholars are well aware is the trajectory by which the Jesus Tao developed from an original text. Matthew, Luke, and even the fourth gospel build on a brief original tale without miracles and post-death appearances, written at an uncertain date by an anonymous author. Church tradition alone identifies this as Mark. Matthew took the story off in one direction, and he packed the text with prophecy. Luke, in contrast, trawled through the works of Josephus for cool tidbits of historical accuracy. Whatever else, eyewitness testimonies they are not. And the story was all but unknown until the second half of the second century. Aware of these difficulties, New Testament scholars suggest a number of traditions preceded the gospel tales. And what do these earlier traditions tell us of Jesus? The Essenes anticipated Christianity in a number of respects, as did the Therapeutes of Egypt, held by the church historian Eusebius as early Christian monks, yet they were established well before the Christian era. What then are we to make of the thinly drawn life of Jesus? It certainly appears to owe an extraordinary amount to Jewish scripture, whether drawn from Adam, Moses, Enoch, Melchizedek, Elijah, Elisha, etc. And it's a vast anticipation of the words and deeds of Jesus. Christian apologetics uses the words fulfillment, but a simple word copying explains the same. What are we to make of the multitude of parallels to Jesus' law to be found in ancient world mythology? Even the embarrassed church fathers spoke of diabolical mimicry. It seems that Satan himself clearly understood the true message of the Jewish prophets and was thus able to preempt Christianity centuries before the arrival of Jesus by copycat gods. In fact, we have absolutely no trace or mention of Jesus' exploits anywhere until the Gospels were written decades after the purported events. Desperate to penetrate this fog, some scholars strive to identify an early layer of teaching, said to derive from an historical Jesus. But does a sayings tradition really point to a single author of wise words? The Bible itself provides an answer. We have a sayings collection in the book of Proverbs, which is attributed to Solomon, but it was standard practice in the ancient world to lend authority and prestige to new material by falsely accrediting a prestigious figure from the past. But even more fatal to the claim of a sayings tradition is the patent failure of anyone to record any of the supposed astounding new teachings at the time. If a great multitude throughout Syria, Galilee, and the Judea heard and believed, how odd that no one recorded those sparkling gems of wisdom. The truth is that Christianity grew from neither a god nor a man, but out of what had gone before. A human Jesus was no more necessary than was a human Horus, Dionysus, Mithras, etc. Can we explain the emergence of Christianity without its superstar? Of course we can. For 2 centuries the Christian movement languished, and thanks to civil war it got its big chance. It was the ultimate product of ancient religious syncretism. But it isn't history, it isn't truth, it's more astounding rubbish from the New Testament.
Well, there's your mini sermonette from Terrible Tommy for on Freya's Day here, Ladies' Day in the Bunker. That's right. Now, I'd recommend, and of course most of you know a lot of this, but there's a lot to know, too, about this fake stuff that the Jews foisted on us way back, and that's how they got, it's really how they made a beachhead into Europe, was out of North Africa and then through Rome, and then it spread all over the place. Interestingly enough, the last Aryan heathen kingdom to fall, I believe, was in the Eastern European country. I think it was Lithuania or thereabouts. So, and it took them hundreds of years to finally stamp our native religions out and replace it with this fake Jewish replacement. Anyhow, you go to JesusNeverExisted.com, and any question you have or anything you want to pass on to young people or even old people, if they'll listen, it's there. And our people desperately need to know these things, because we cannot go on in the future faced with the problems we're going to be faced with and are faced with now, dragging this Jewish nonsense and mythology behind us. I mean, it'd be like a small motor boat with a bunch of cement blocks tied on the back on a rope, trying to negotiate the ocean waves and so forth like that. And so you can't do it. And every time I get in an argument or debate with these racially conscious people that are okay on the race issue, but they cannot seem to divest themselves of this mythology, which it shows, as Ben Klassen was trying to show us, that this stuff is killing us, is killing our race. And those of you who are big into National Socialism, it was dragging the Third Reich down too, because Adolf Hitler was having to deal with these churches, and he's trying to keep them happy and trying not to have open warfare with the Pope and all that kind of crap. And so here again, it's just dragging these giant blocks of concrete behind you, trying to move up forward up towards the top of Mount Everest. And for all those who complain about Jews and Judaism all the time, if Christianity was out of the picture, the Jews would be out of the picture. I mean, sure, there'd be a small number of them, and maybe they would have a few worship places like that. But speaking on a mass scale, the Jews would be out of business if it wasn't for Christianity. Because who is promoting Judaism the most in the world? It's the Christians. Every church is preaching the Old Testament Torah every Sunday. On the radio shows around here, all these religious shows, they're constantly referring to the writings in the Torah. In other words, the Christian religion is the host for Judaism, and it is doing more to spread that nonsense than the Jews themselves. The Jews sit back and do actually very little, and the Christians carry all their water for them. That's why the top echelon of the Jews and Zionism and so forth would not want to see Christianity severely attacked or eliminated. Because they may claim these differences between the Jews and the Christians, but believe me, they don't want to get rid of Christianity. The Jews do not want to get rid of Jewish Christianity. Not at all. Well, I see the Jew boys have another political candidate here up in the Northeast. And an interesting fella. Wealthy progressives have been hanging their hats in New York's Hudson Valley for almost as long as they existed in this country. starting with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, who both grew up in Dutchess County and routinely repaired to the family estate in Hyde Park. In 1960, Gore Vidal made a run at a House seat that included the county seat of Poughkeepsie, as well as a handful of surrounding towns, a campaign that touched off an accusation of carpetbagging. And don't forget, I ran against Gore Vidal in 82 for U.S. Senate in California. Yeah, I think I've told you that many times. Now, another idealistic, wealthy young Jew liberal is vying to represent what today is the state's 19th congressional district, a horseshoe-shaped entity that runs on both sides of the river all the way up towards Albany and Schenectady. Like Roosevelt and Vidal, Sean Eldridge has the luxury of being independently wealthy. Now, catch this. Sean Eldridge has, his husband, Chris Hughes, is the owner of the New Republic magazine. They were Harvard roommates of Mark Zuckerberg's and helped launch Facebook, affording them the ability to buy an estate worth nearly $2 million in the district to facilitate and run. After publicly buying a $5 million spread an hour or so south of Garrison in 2012. You see, that's the kind of leaders you get now, homosexual millionaires. But unlike his progressive predecessors, Eldridge has a Hebrew middle name, Simcha, S-I-M-C-H-A. And a family story that stretches from Central Europe to Montreal, where he was born, and then to Ohio, where he was raised. His Jew background isn't something he hides, but neither is it something the candidate emphasizes on the ballot. He uses a middle initial. The name Sean Eldridge somehow doesn't jump out at people, he acknowledged when he met for lunch in Rhinebeck in early May. Yeah. Well, he may not want to talk about too much about his Jewishness, but Jewish magazines and papers do. It only adds to the air of opacity surrounding the 27-year-old who also runs a venture capital firm, Hudson River Ventures, based in Kingston, right in the middle of the district, and at least until recently was a regular site in New York City and Washington, where the New Republic is based. The Republican incumbent, Chris Gibson, a local who served multiple combat tours in the U.S. Army and taught politics at West Point, has worked to make Eldridge's recent arrival into both the district and public life the main issue in the race. Quote, this is about him and his political aspirations, and I think that's going to be a problem for him. He married well into money, Gibson told Politico recently, but there are some things money can't buy. Well, the way I read this thing, he married a guy. I don't know what I'm missing here, but anyhow. Yet Eldridge clearly thinks of himself as a disruptor, like his husband. Yeah. His husband, and Zuckerberg. He points to his involvement in the marriage equality campaign in New York and an array of other progressive, don't you like that? I call it regressive issues as evidence that his priorities are better in touch with those of the district's voters, whereas he was previously content to work on politics from the outside, serving on the boards of local groups like Planned Parenthood and Scenic Hudson. Now, wait a minute. He was an unmarried homosexual Jew working in the Planned Parenthood scene. And has been involved in the Regressive Power Donor Club Democracy Alliance. Eldridge has clearly decided that role isn't for him. quote, the most important thing I do is to step up and run and hopefully move our country in a better direction, he says. There's such a lack of urgency. I think we need more urgency, more impatience. Well, I guess the... As recently as December 2012, Hughes was insisting to reporters that his husband, God, had no immediate plans to get into public life. I can understand if it wasn't politics, but now they're so far out in the open that it's okay, my husband. No, 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 Hughes told his New York profiler, Carl Swanson. He's 26, and he's going to do all kinds of things in politics. But I don't think there's any rush. In other words, he's supposed to stay home and take care of the dishes and the laundry, his husband. In truth, Eldridge has been openly planning his political career since he was a teenager because he had all kinds of money. Why not? The serfs need a new master. The winter 2005 newsletter of his alma mater, Deep Springs College, a kind of ranch commune for hyper-intellectual young men in rural California just north of Death Valley, includes the following entry. Quote, Sean Eldridge comes from Toledo, Ohio, where he studied flute. Yeah, I bet he did. And starred in numerous high school musicals. Sean is a citizen of Israel. Ah, and Canada, and will soon become an American to pursue a political career in this country while not giving up his Israeli citizenship. Mm-hmm. His mother, Sarah Taub, a family physician, was born in Petah Tikva, Israel. Her father, Zvi, is a former Hungarian soldier who survived, oh, here we go, the Mauthausen-Gusen concentration camp, and met Eldridge's grandmother, Gita, a survivor of Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen at a family camp in Italy after the war. I knew that would get in there someplace. Let's see here. The family made its way to Canada, don't they all, settling in Montreal where Zwi worked as a tailor and Gita as a hairdresser, raising their daughter in Orthodox tradition. My mother learned how to speak English by watching cartoons on television. Eldridge wrote in a Mother's Day post on his campaign website, Taub insisted Sean's father, Stephen, convert before they got married in Montreal. Eldridge was born there and spent his childhood going to the to a conservative shul in Toledo, where his mother, now divorced, still lives with her practice in nearby rural Milan, Michigan. After a brief stint in Ann Arbor, he went for one summer to Jewish summer camp outside Cleveland, but spent a few more years at Michigan's Interlochen Arts Camp. Well, let's see here. Is there anything more interesting? Goes on and on. Yeah, these Jews, they brag like hell in their own periodicals, which is good. I'm glad they brag. So there you go. You got a effeminate looking Jew and his effeminate husband running for Congress against a guy who is evidently a white Aryan soldier and hero of the Middle Eastern wars or something. I don't know. What do I know? I'm just telling you the little I do know, okay? There you've got it. You've got, number one, he's a Jew. Number two, he's homosexual. Number three, he's a very rich, rich Jew. That's a dangerous combination. Well, here's another little story that you might find interesting. As soon as I get it up here. What? Did you see? No. For an industry run primarily by Jews, Hollywood had long been fearful of any special pleading for Jewish causes. In the years leading up to the American entry in World War II, in other words, the killing of millions of white people, American films had chosen not to talk about the tenuous status of European Jewry, even in films ostensibly about the Nazi menace. The word Jew famously never made an appearance in the 1940 anti-Nazi drama The Mortal Storm. But as writer Mark Harris describes in his fascinating new book, Five Came Back, prominent American filmmakers returned from World War II convinced that Hollywood would have to grow up at long last and tell the adult stories marinated in pain and horror of the real world at home and abroad, but concentrate on the Jewish pain, not anybody else's pain. A series of award-winning pictures followed, as Hollywood was quick to pat itself on the back. The 1945 Best Picture winner, The Lost Weekend, starring Ray Milland, deals with the subject of Jewish alcoholism, and the 46th Best Picture winner, The Best Years of Our Life, tackles the topic of reintegration of World War II veterans back home. Fitting squarely into this trend was Elia Kazan's Gentleman's Agreement, which in 1947 took on an equally serious topic, one long ignored by Jewish-run Hollywood: anti-Semitism. General Agreement screens on Turner Classic Movies on May 18th. Whoa, that's just a couple of days. I guess that's Sunday. And to watch it today is to glimpse both the virtues and the limitations of the newly mature Hollywood described by Harris, one in which prestige and seriousness are intertwined with kikery. In the film version of Gentleman's Agreement, Gregory Peck, who was a long, long-time Hollywood liberal, plays Philip Green, a prominent journalist, recently relocated to New York and assigned the task of writing a magazine series on anti-Semitism. After struggling to locate a hook for the series, Green settles on a catchy stunt. Quote, "I was Jewish for 6 months," unquote. Green looks at himself in the mirror and assesses his hair, eyes, and mannerisms, and assuring himself that each could pass as Jewish. Well, hell, anybody could pass as Jewish, because Jews come in all races and all forms and ethnic backgrounds and so forth. So he should have been smart enough to know that. He then proceeds to present himself to his new colleagues and friends as Jewish. And the film is assembled out of his charged encounters with editors, secretaries, hotel managers, and superintendents, each of whom reveals a new facet of prejudice against the Jews. Poor Jews, man. Kazan based Gentleman's Agreement on the best-selling novel by former advertising writer and Time Incorporated executive Laura Z. Hobson, who many readers assumed was, like her protagonist, not Jewish. While identifying herself as an avowed secular, Hobson, born Laura Zemetkin, was Jewish as well, making for a mobile strip of shifting cultural allegiances. A Jewish author with a waspish name creating a non-Jewish character intent on passing himself off as Jewish for the purpose of peeling back the ugly truth about anti-Semitism. And to add another layer, the film version was produced by the sole major non-Jewish studio head, Fox's Daryl F. Zanuck. According to Richard Schickels, Elia Kazan, Harry Warner of Warner Brothers organized a meeting of studio executives in a fruitless attempt to convince Zanuck to drop his plans for fear of prompting more anti-Semitism by tackling the topic head on. See, most of the powerful Jews wanted to hide their Jewishness because they knew what would happen if they
did. A vast virus database has been updated.
Quit interrupting me. That broad, I'm going to have to do something about her. Oh, here's a little bit more. Gentlemen's agreement is about passing, requiring the presumably disinterested Gentile intermediary of Philip Green to give its audience access to the brutality of anti-Semitism. Jews are represented here primarily as returning vet named Dave Goldman, a wonderful fellow played by John Garfield, a wonderful fellow who never hurt anybody, might feel the anguish of anti-Semitism, but contemporary social mores seem to require a non-Jew to explain, codify, and present it. The film version of Gentleman's Agreement is a strange mix of daring and cowardness. It was, in the words of film historian Siegfried Krakauer, quote, a mountain of dialogue bringing forth a mouse, unquote. Names are most decidedly named. Prominent anti-Semites like Representative John Rankin, who once called Walter Winchell the little kike, which he was a little kike. I don't see why they'd be upset with that. Mississippi Senator Theodore Bilbo and America's first founder Gerald L. K. Smith are mentioned as are well-heeled Connecticut towns like Darien and New Canaan, notorious for keeping the Jews out of their town. And yet, anti-Semitism is a distinctly local affair here confined to the United States and the well-heeled corridors of the East Coast at that. Kazan's film is a remarkable document, a vanished era of American Jewish life, as much as what it chooses not to depict as what it does. Well, anyhow, I like that they mentioned Theodore Bilbo, Representative John Rankin, Gerald L.K. Smith, of which, what's his name? I'm trying to remember. And Wesley Swift, who a lot of people knew in the identity movement, was the driver for Gerald L.K. Smith. And also there was a lady that was a secretary, Opal Tanner White, secretary to Gerald L.K. Smith, that ended up being very prominent in the Wallace campaigns for president operating out of California. And she was also very active in the American Independent Party in the 70s. And she was the wife of Walter White, which you may have read some of his stuff. I'm sorry to say, he put together a fake confession by top Jews about what they were doing, sort of like an updated Elders of Zion out piece. It was written well, but it was fake. And I knew about it. And also, was involved in his own fake kidnapping, allegedly by Irv Rubin, to which Walter White's friends asked I and my Klan group to try to find him. And it took a while, but he finally turned up. Actually, we didn't find him, but we found out that he had a propensity to run off with younger girls and shack up in a motel. And so he had falsely accused Irv Rubin, who was never a friend of mine, but anyhow. And unfortunately, that led to some of the Klansmen that worked with me to go out and, in the process of looking for Irv Rubin, being set up by an L.A. undercover informant cop in a supposed assassination attempt on Irv Rubin But they got the wrong Herb Rubin. But anyhow, it was all set up with cops, and they drug these guys away. But unfortunately, this is what happens a lot of times in the right wing, that Walter White caused the whole damn problem. And it was very interesting that after all that, and a guy went to prison for trying to save his ass, that Walter White never apologized to myself or the men that he damaged. This has no real bearing on Opal Tanner White, except that she covered for him. And that was wrong. But anyhow, that's sort of a little side story on that. But they're still putting that story out that Walter White wrote about his interview with this top Jew who confessed to everything that they were that the Jews are doing in this country. Of course, the top Jews are not going to confess to everything they're doing, dummy. But anyhow, it's still referred to in the right wing. They still refer people to it, but it was a total fraud. Not that they're probably not doing things like that, but he never had that interview. That interview was with a top U.S. senator, Jew senator, Jacob Javits, as I recall. One of the most slick sons of bitches Jews in the United States Senate. But White must have used a pseudonym for Javits, because I'm sure that Javits would have probably sued his ass off if he'd used his name. Anyhow, if you want to fight the Jews by using the same slippery lying tactics they use, it's going to come back and backfire on you. Not that we shouldn't use clever methods to go against the Jews, but if we begin to turn into an exact replica of what they're doing, who are we? Well, here's an interesting piece of information. A new study could help resolve a long-standing debate about the origins of the first people to inhabit the Americas. Researchers report in the journal Science. The study relies on genetic information extracted from the tooth of an adolescent girl who fell into a sinkhole in Yucatan in 12 to 13,000 years ago. Well, that's interesting. Genetic evidence in the new study supports the hypothesis that the first people in America all came from Northeast Asia by crossing the land bridge known as Beringia. When sea levels rose after the last ice age, the land bridge disappeared. Yeah. The girl's remains were found alongside those of ancient extinct beasts that also fell into the inescapable natural trap, as researchers described the sinkhole. The team used radiocarbon dating and analyzed chemical signatures in bones and in flower-like crystals that grew on the bones to determine how long ago the girl lived. University of Illinois anthropology professor Ripon Malhi analyzed DNA from a girl who died 12,000 to 13,000 years ago in Yucatan. Scientists have long debated the origins of the first Americans. Most accept the numerous genetic analysis support the view that the original immigrants crossed over a land bridge that once connected Northeast Asia to the present-day Alaska. The most ancient remains have baffled scientists, however, because the skulls are narrower and have other measurable different features than those of Native Americans. In other words, the Indians, so-called Indians, were Mongols and had bigger heads, wider heads. Narrow skulls indicate possible Aryans. Some researchers hypothesize that these individuals came to America from as far away as Australia or Southeast Asia. The girl fell into the sinkhole, had a skull with the usual shape, and luckily for the researchers, her bones still held genetic material that could be analyzed to determine her origins. Quote, there are lots and lots of theories about the peopling of the Americas and who was here and when, said the University of Illinois Anthropology and Institute of Genomic Biology Professor Ripon Mahi, whose lab was one of the three to conduct genetic analysis for the new study. And it seems like a genetic research is slowly falsifying a lot of those theories. The laboratories of Brian Kemp in Washington State University and Deborah Balnick of the University of Texas each independently extracted and analyzed mitochondrial DNA from the ancient girl's tooth. Genetic material from the mitochondria, energy-generating structures found in every cell, is more plentiful than found in the nucleus of the cells, and so it's easier to study. Mahi, who analyzed the DNA, focused on regions of the metagenome that code specific proteins. Well, on and on that goes. Let's see here. We were able to identify her genetic lineage with high certainty. This shows that living Native Americans and these ancient remains of the girl we analyzed all came from the same source population during the initial peopling of the Americas. Forensic anthropologist and archaeologist and paleontologist James Chatters of Applied Paleoscience in Bothell, Washington, led the new analysis. Chatters is best known for his work on Kennewick Man, another ancient individual whose origins were debated because his skull was markedly different from those of Native Americans. The Kennewick Man remains were found in Kennewick, Washington in 1996 and were probably of white or Aryan or European background. So there you go. There you go. Gradually the truth comes out, right? Well, I'm sending you a picture of allegedly our dictator, our head oligarchist, Obamsky, bowing to King Saud of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, as far as I'm concerned, is probably one of our greatest enemies. And here is this bisexual nigger bowing to him. Did you see anything about this in the American press? I never did. I never did. I might have seen Bush bowing to Saudis, because all the American leaders for a long time have been bowing to the Saudis. And some of them even turn around and get it in the rear end from the Saudis. Well, I see that the only two states that haven't, were not facing a challenge to their bans on same-sex marriage are Montana and North Dakota. I don't know, Craig Cobb must have had some influence while he was there. Well, they found a judge that's upholding the D.C. gun registration requirement. A District of Columbia judge has upheld the city gun registration requirements, including re-registration every 3 years, a safety class requirement, and a photographing and fingerprinting of all gun owners. Well, they probably need to do that because there's probably so many people in Washington, D.C. that might be thinking of gunning for big game. they got to check it out. Judge James Boasberg ruled Thursday that the city had shown substantial evidence. Well, substantial evidence was that the city's full of niggers and Islamics coming in. We got to watch those guns, man. that the regulations achieve important governmental interests. In other words, congressmen and senators don't want to get their asses shot off. And that they are narrowly tailored to such ends. I love that legalese talk. The city put the requirements in place in 2008 after a landmark Supreme Court decision that ended a 32-year-old handgun ban in the nation's capital. Man, I can understand those politicians wanting a handgun control in Washington, D.C. If you don't understand it, you can't figure it out. Well, I'm not going to tell you. It's a secret. Okay. And on the environmental scene, here we go again. Big mammals versus big oil. A new pipeline puts humpback whales at risk in a deep fjord in British Columbia called the Douglas Channel, where the Kitimat River flows, pours, runs off the Chinook salmon into the Pacific Ocean. Fishermen see singing humpback whales fling themselves into the air. These barnacled 40-ton whales with long ridge flippers were harpooned to the brink of extinction in the 1900s. Only through intense conservation efforts have they found safety in ancient migration routes. Mothers birth a single calf in a tropical sea and fast for 4 months as it nurses before migrating thousands of miles up to the North Pacific. There in enclaves like the Douglas Channel, a critical feeding ground, the whales nourish themselves on krill. They're amazingly beautiful. They'll knock your socks off, said Tracy John Hittill, a fishing lodge owner in Kitimat, a town on the channel. Hittell takes guests to see the whales in a 30-foot fishing boat. Quote, they'll come so close you can see their eye right against yours, she says. Now the humpbacks are the flashpoint of an environmental battle. Environmentalists cried foul last month when the Canadian government stripped the whales of protection under its Species at Risk Act, Canada's equivalent to the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Stephen Harper's administration, and this guy is the enemy of all enemies of the environment. He has stripped Canada of almost all protection. He downgraded the status of humpbacks from threatened to species of special concern. To add to the problem, many fear that a massive pipeline poised to pump 500,000 barrels of crude oil a day into tanker ships in the Douglas Channel is on the verge of being approved. The Northern Gateway Pipeline, similar to another pipeline roiling politics in the United States, the Keystone XL, would affect the whales' feeding grounds. An announcement on Northern Gateway is expected in June from Prime Minister Harper. Well, it might pay to get behind the resistance to this kind of crap up there in Canada. Pass the word along. Anywhere there's a pipeline, there's going to be a possibility of major, major environmental destruction. And this would be really bad. And of course, the XL, they're going to bring that pipe all the way down from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico to put on ships to send it to other countries, not for use in the United States, and not to give us a bunch of jobs here either. That XL pipeline's a bunch of crap. And it'll be a target, too, probably, for destruction and attack by, Islamic fanatics. Why wouldn't they want to attack super pipelines like that? They're easy. You can't have security on those things. Minimum security. And then you got all these tanker loads of oil going over the railroads now, running off the tracks and spilling. I'm telling you, the environment is really, really under attack. Well, let's look at the heartland here. Ohio annually processes thousands of tons of radioactive waste from hydraulic fracturing, sending it through treatment facilities, injecting it into its old and unused gas wells, and dumping it in landfills. Historically, the handling and disposal of that waste was barely regulated, with few requirements for how its potential contamination would be gauged and how and where it could be transported and stored. Remember, even if you have an all-white society, if you contaminate the ground beyond a certain point, no race can survive. With the business of fracking waste only growing, legislators in 2013 had the chance to decide how best to monitor the state's vast amounts of toxic material, much of it being trucked into Ohio from neighboring states. And also, of course, the State Department is dumping thousands of Somalian niggers into Ohio, right next door to us here in Indiana. But despite calls to require the waste to be rigorously tested for contamination, Governor John Kasich and the state legislature signed off on measures that require just a fraction of the waste to be subject to such oversight. The great majority of the byproduct creating during the drilling process, the water and rock unearthed, still do not have to be tested at all. As well, the legislature, lobbied by the fracking industry, undid the governor's bid to have testing of the waste done by the state's Department of Health, the agency acknowledged by many to possess the most expertise with radioactive material. The testing is now the responsibility of the Department of Natural Resources, the agency that oversees and permitting the inspection of oil and gas drilling sites, but that has no track record for dealing with radioactive waste. Well, you see, the Christians are all sitting around waiting to be taken to heaven. They're not worried about it. What the hell they care about? This old earth's going to go away, and they're going to be taken right out of their cars and houses to heaven and the whole bit. So the ignorance and insanity of the Christian religion is at the basis of a lot of this stupidity that's going on in these states, where they think you can just keep going on dumping everything into the land and into the water. And it's, well, so what if the earth goes bad? We're going to go to heaven, stupid bastards. Well, with that sorry news, I'm out of here. 14:05, and I'm going to try to go out with a little more positive note with a song for our she-wolves out there, the ladies. 14:05, and shut up.
If we make it through December, everything's gonna be alright, I know. It's the coldest time of winter, and I shiver when I see the falling snow. If we make it through December, got plans to be in a warmer town come summertime. Maybe even California. If we make it through December, we'll be fine. Got laid off down at the factory, and their timing's not the greatest in the world. Heaven knows I've been working hard. Ordered Christmas to be right for Daddy's girl. I don't mean to hate December. It's meant to be the happy time of year. but my little girl don't understand why daddy can't afford no Christmas here. But if we make it through December, everything's gonna be alright, I know. It's the coldest time of winter, and I shiver when I see falling snow. If we make it through December, we got plans to be in a warmer town come summertime. Maybe even California. If we make it through December, we'll be fine. One you can rub belly button limp and limp on, or you can trade belly button limp. This is one to dance to. This may be the last dance tune of the year. Dance with somebody you like, and if it causes problems, change back to the partners you were with before the song started. Today I started loving you again, and I'm right back where I've really always been. I got over you just long enough to let my heart ache mend. And that the day I started loving you again, what a fool I was to think the goodbye. With only these few million tears I cry, I should have known the worst is yet to come, and the trying time for me had just begun. Today I started loving you again, and I'm right back where I've really always been. I got over you just long enough to let my heart ache mend. And then today I started loving you again.
And that was Merle Haggard in concert at Billy Bob's place down there in Texas. That was from his Motorcycle Cowboy album.